war.
By the way, not even before the war.
You wanted to talk before
little,
the war. Yes.
Little. Let me tell you this. As I told you at school, I was not very encouraged. I was not bad, not good. I was never top of any form. I wasn't really thought particularly clever or brilliant or anything. I started rather low, partly because I just arrived in the country probably, about a year after, 2 years after. I gradually hoisted myself. I wasn't very good at Latin and not very good at Greek. I don't know. I mean, I was quite good. But I didn't have any sense of competition. And therefore, broadly speaking, if I have any natural modesty, it was reinforced by my performances in school. I was sort of sixth, seventh, fifth in the form, ninth, second right towards the end, but never first. And I used to work terribly hard, because it was a cramming school. They wanted the boys to get scholarships more than anything else in the world. Even if you could afford to come up without one, they still wanted to be top of the league and that sort of thing.
Yeah. This is St. Paul's.
St. Paul's, and this was a lower middle class school in many ways, middle to the lower middle. There were no upper class boys and no proletarian really. Not quite one of the proletarian boys. Anyway, there I was. And then I lived at home, I made friends, had quite a peaceful, uncompetitive, overworked life. I used to work every evening for 4 hours, otherwise I really couldn't get the homework done. I did a certain amount of cribbing, which is why I haven't read Latin and Greek properly, because I bought, as everyone did, translations in Charing Cross Road, where the cribs came from. Then I went on. Then I was sent up for a scholarship at Balliol. I didn't get it. Then my school wrote, they wouldn't give me a place in Balliol, even if I had to pay for it, and they said no. It wasn't good enough to be accepted at all.
Did this rankle?
A bit of time, yes. 1927? Yes. Autumn, whatever it was. I think it was spring 27, yes. I mean, to be told I couldn't enter college. It was the only college I put down, because I thought it would be good enough to try and pay for a scholarship. And they did take, so I can't have been all that bad. And then, later that year, the autumn of that same year, maybe the spring of the next one, I got a scholarship at Corpus Christi. That was a tremendous liberation, actually. I left my parents' house and was totally freed. And beginning of the red set.
And you're 21.
I'm now 20.
20? No.
We're now in 1928.
So you're 20.
And therefore, I'm 19. I'm 19. Rather early.
What do you look like at 19?
I was fat. And black hair.
Lots of hair.
Yes, not tremendous. Plump, certainly fat.
Bushy eyebrows.
Probably.
Prominent ears?
Sure. Rough photographs of that period.
Yeah.
School, I mean, college photographs
yeah.
exist. And I became very lively at that point.
Are there parenthetically family photograph albums?
Not quite that, but plenty of photographs. I mean, 10 or 12, I mean. From myself as sort of the age of 2, sailor suit to the age of 7, all that exists.
Yeah.
In Petersburg, that kind of thing does exist.
Yeah.
Now, at that point, I went to Corpus Christi College. I got over my humiliation at Balliol. Humiliation wasn't great. I thought I didn't deserve it. I didn't think I was unjustly treated. Because I was probably justly. I was rather, so to speak, got down by it. I said, oh well, I'm no good, that sort of thing, but no worse than that. And then I began to bloom slightly. And Corpus, I've described it to you.
When did you have first intimations of a bloom?
Only when I got a collection prize. Collections being college examinations, rather than university ones, of a sort of straw vote type. But there was a prize for one of these collections called the Hague Prize, which I got. That would have been in 1960, 31. Not much before that. I was 20. Well, no, it wasn't. I was 21 in 1930. So it might have been 21. Between 20 and 21, that sort of thing. And then I made friends with various people. I became editor of a Highbrow magazine called the Oxford Outlook. That sort of got me on.
Yes.
And that sort of thing. But it was the rescue of me, really. I hadn't started to live much before I got to university. My mother was always very worried about the fact that I hated dancing when I was young. I might grow up into a terrible bookish child, not marry, because I didn't for years, and altogether be a sort of indoors, bookish, no good, uncirculatable. But once I got to Oxford, that was all right. Somehow that was all right. But scholarship, I was to Oxford, made new friends, that was okay. So that period was all right. Then I got interested in philosophy. I had an absolutely wonderful tutor who exhausted himself in teaching. Extremely clever, modest, sharp, clever. Couldn't get away with a single piece of rhetoric. However harmless. Not explaining exactly what one meant very clearly. Extremely deflationary. The same just and kind.
Yes.
Because both these things are still alive. To my own great deal.
His name?
Hardy. He was a great son of a classical scholar, classical scholar himself, brother of another one, got all the prizes from Baylor in his day, modest, shy, rather repressed, Scottish, from Edinburgh, strong Scotch accent, written a few books which are not particularly praised, Plato and Aristotle, knew a lot of Greek, but was a very minute tutor, and extremely careful and never humiliated one. Merely correct. So this can't be right, because you say so and so. But in what way do you mean that? But that can't be right, can it? Because.
Yeah.
All done with extreme gentleness and firmness. I didn't know if anyone else liked that, really. That had a permanent effect on me, by which I then clarity became a obsessive value to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one might be shallow, one might be superficial, but obscurity and pretentiousness and sentences which tumbled over themselves came up to the horror from then till this moment.
Is there any possibility that you came to Oxford with a kind of expansive Russian mind, which to Hardy's way of thinking was slightly untied?
Oh yes, he thought I was quite clever. He realized I was quite clever because he made me go into all souls. I would never have thought it. All souls are remote from me. It was a sort of upper kind of House of Lords which I never really knew what went on inside it. I never thought for a moment that it's conceivably fit for it.
Yes, but it was his suggestion.
His suggestion.
But only after...
They must have thought I was bright.
But only after he'd knocked you into shape and something.
Well, I got a first, which in Corpus, in that particular, has been great, and it's still lit hum. Lit hum in your was unusual, because the philosopher before him was a famous philosopher called Schiller, who was a friend and pupil of William James. His views were so unacceptable in Oxford that nobody he thought could ever get good marks. The ancient history tutor was totally stupid and about 90, and not quite there, but was a sort of old British soldier type who had been all right in the 1890s. Wasn't much good by the 20s. So nobody ever got any kinds of first classes in that. Then they were replaced. No, Grundy was still there, my ancient history tutor. But Hardy was a genuine trainer of philosophers. Something like six philosophers came out of Corpus. His day, all of whom got fellowships, all of whom made careers. He was a tremendous teacher of, without being a prominent philosopher himself. Frightfully good at practicing sort of Mr. Pleath, the greatest cello teacher in the world, but not first-class cellist himself.
Yeah.
I owe him great. Because by nature, I was, of course, as you might imagine, had a jungle-like mind. Did not form sentences. Everything was topsy-turvy. The Russian was completely rich and vague and rooms, so to speak, and overfilled and multicolored, and everything tumbled over everything.
So Oxford taught you a style of thought which was, in a sense, antithetical to what you
it was.
To what you were.
Certainly. Nothing was good. I could never have made an academic if I had gone on, except in English literature or something, which was not a subject for that reason. Because, I mean, a great deal of it is nothing but hollow rhetoric to this day. It's an academic discipline, mm-hmm. as you well know.
Yeah.
Not hollow, perhaps, but certainly rhetoric.
But it taught you an abiding suspicion of rhetoric.
Not rhetoric so much. I rather like it. Abiding suspicion of pretentiousness and confusion.
Yeah.
And just sort of wordiness. Although I am very wordy. Nobody can deny that I use a great many words. But very few do. Nevertheless, the kind of reviews I read, by pretentious review, I've just read a review in the New York Review of Books by a perfectly respectable professor of German, whose name you'll know, called, I think, J.P. Stern,
mm-hmm.
of a biography of Heidegger.
Yeah.
It was perfectly clear to me that he tried to convey some of the ideas of Heidegger without understanding them at all. I don't know what they are, but nobody reading it could tell.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Therefore, you shouldn't have taken it on.
Yeah.
To try and convey at that level is proof
yeah.
of some kind of total lack of intellectual cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
His book on Nietzsche, similarly. Mm-hmm. Quite a good book at a certain level. Tells his story, tells mm-hmm. what he said, but if you really want to know what makes Nietzsche wonderful, you will not get it from him. But at the kind of Noel Allen level, it works.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? I'm very suspicious of Dr. Leavis. I didn't approve of, but I admired to some extent. That was an attempt to make criticism a real weapon. Mm-hmm. Fanatical, narrow, wrong, but...
Rigorous.
Rigorous and clear.
Mm-hmm.
And honest, I mean, genuine.
Yeah.
Genuine, perhaps noxious, but genuine.
Mm-hmm.
You see, equally I admired David Sissel. That was cosery, but very clever and delightful, and meant something.
Yeah.
It wasn't very profound, it was charming. And it, and being a very clever man, it was amusing and agreeable and exhilarating.
And it was clear?
He said,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What one doesn't like is sort of George Steiner, I mean, which is sort of Hannah Arendt. I mean, that's what I react against. Very
the higher German nonsense.
Yes. Which I hate. Didn't really prove. I think it's, I mean, I have a sort of deep personal loathing of it.
Why loathing?
Can't tell you. Just because I think it's getting away with it, because I think it's kind of charlatan.
Yeah.
And that is it. I respect moral moral qualities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, intellectual morality.
Mm-hmm.
About which people at least are honest.
About what they know and what they don't know.
Yes, and they're honest about what they think. They really say what they think and not write sentences.
Mm-hmm.
Not just get themselves into some kind of fuzz or fog
yeah.
and then just go on generating.
Yeah.
The famous case, someone telling me, I don't know if it's true, but it's all typical, of the publisher, Cotta, saying to Hegel that something he'd written didn't seem to have gone long enough to make a proper volume. Would he mind adding some more. Hegel with that difficulty. And I realized then maybe there's a certain tendency at what might be called kind of somnambulistic talk. I mean, just
yeah.
sheer rhetoric.
Yes.
Just using what the French call cliquetis de formule. It's a wonderful phrase.
What is it?
Cliquetis de formule.
Cliquetis
de. I don't know what cliquetis means, I suspect.
Yeah.
CLI. CLIQUETI, yes.
Nothing
like clicking in and out.
Yes.
Means a sort of coining, the
yes.
sort of minting
yes.
of formulae.
Yes.
We just have a sort of formula this, formula that.
Yes.
One formula clicks against the other.
Right. And that you suspect.
Piatta.
Yes,
Piatta.
Yeah.
But I don't mind Piatta very much, but pretentious Piatta.
And you think you learned all this from Hardy?
Well, I think so.
First
before
name,
that,
Hardy's first name?
Frank.
Frank.
W.F.R. William Francis something, Henry Fonda.
Still alive.
But still alive, aged 87.
Do you ever see him?
Not in very much now, because he lives near a golf club. He hardly appears to be very old. But I would see him if he came into Oxford ever. I'd rather like to. In fact, I feel guilty about not seeing him. I went on a holiday with him once in Salzburg. I was very shocked because he found it.
Why?
Too cynical. Too cynical. Dreadful. Dreadful. Simple, honorable, in fact, naive, very clever, superb classical scholar. Hence all his character. People who are very good at Greek, very good at Latin, have extremely clear minds.
Now, you then...
Then, all right. Then
what I want to know is we've talked at some length about All Souls' life in the 30s, and I suspect that you think we've talked about the politicians and the...
Well, sure,
but we have not talked about... What have we missed? That's what I want to know.
In the 30s?
Yeah.
Have I told you I got the New College? Crossman.
Yes.
I told you it.
Yes.
The lies that Crossman told.
No, that I don't.
Well, look, I was quite a, I became quite a decent philosophical undergraduate. And I joined the thing called the Jewish Society, which was the undergraduate philosophical society. Did you find anything?
Nothing at all for her. Nothing to say. Or make.
They could probably sell you. They could sell you. Yeah. Those people do. Moss Bros sell things.
Yeah,
Moss Bros
is no longer.
Who is
it? Who's in Clarkson? You have to get made in Savile Row. You have to go to one of these great tailors.
If we look at Clarkson's. Just look up the word Clarkson. Telephone book.
In what?
Shop.
That's what?
Costumiers. Costumiers.
Oh, yeah.
This is an irrelevant little piece of information. There's a thing called Letters from Iceland by Horden and McNeice. And they went to Iceland. And a lot of poetry and prose and so ragbag and stuff. In the middle of that, there are bequests to various people they know. And some of them don't know, but know about. And Louis McNeice did. Almost all of them. And then he says, I was reading this book quite peacefully in bed in a small little village near Salzburg in 1936, I think. Suddenly I came across my name with horror. And I remember being very annoyed. To Michael Jeffrey Thackeray, a gown of quilted silk. To Isaiah Berlin, a saucer of milk. I didn't like that at all.
No.
After that, my relations really have never been good, broken off.
What do they mean by
it? I'm catty. Must be in there.
Yeah.
So you give cats.
Yeah.
All can be. No, not to me. That was the other man. It rhymed.
It rhymed.
The word silk.
That's it.
Rhymed with milk. Yeah. To somebody else. Yeah. Like Jeffrey Thackeray. Yeah. A gown of watered silk, whatever that is.
Yeah.
What is watered silk?
Very beautiful silk, whatever it is.
Right. To Isaiah Berlin, saw some milk.
I see, I told you.
I still remember going
still
shivering in bed. Suddenly, coming across one's name. I had to sort of, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
One gets
a frisson.
The house is frisson. And then I met Louis McNeice fairly soon afterwards. And he said, I understand we're not in very good terms. I said, so far as I'm concerned, we're on no terms at all. Quite pleased to see him too.
Yeah,
I don't often have powers of repartee.
Yes, but you had it that time.
Yes. And we're doing.
How did McNeice know you?
He was a contemporary, but he was the contemporary man at Oxford.
Yeah.
He never met me at Oxford. Too grand for me to know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, he was a very leading eccentric poet.
Yeah.
Wore a long, flowing cloak. Mm. And used to get drunk.
So, how did he know that you deserved a saucer of milk?
Cool. From talk.
From talk.
About other people.
Yeah.
No, never. I don't think he'd ever. I don't think I'd ever had a conversation with him. Not to my knowledge.
But word is circulated that you had a malicious tongue.
No doubt. No doubt. I feel there's some truth in it. sharp tongue, you might call it. Kind of version, exactly the same.
Yes.
Yeah. Of course I made nasty jokes, I'm sure, all my life. Yeah. I remember the source of milk. I never really got over it.
I promise you, I will ask my friend.
You know who would find out better, Grace Dudley, than
I do? Not in London, she wouldn't.
She lives in Geneva.
Oh, New York.
Paris, they might do. Paris would have been Paris. Chardin.
Surely,
I haven't quite enough imagination to go to any other teaching. Say exactly what I want to find the right stuff.
Yes. Well, I think I know. I know a lady prominent in the costume business. I will canvas this problem and give you a report.
But Covent Garden will tell you. Yes. The dress department of Covent Garden will certainly know.
Yeah.
I've been through it once, as director. I met all the ladies.
I could at least look at their model.
That is more difficult. But you just ask for Don Pasquale. That's all you need. That we have easily arranged for Jeremy Isaacs.
But in the last Don Pasquale, he only had a jacket. It doesn't matter what.
What? Who?
The one they made
Don Pasquale.
No, it's wrong. No, you should have a long one. Made a short one, that's a very great mistake. Can't think of anyone else who wears a dressing gown in either play or opera. Yes, they did wear a quilted one, I think. Not particularly the one, operatic dressing gown. You must ask Jeremy Isaacs to tell you who is the head of the dress department?
Yeah, I have to start from the
top. Thou always. It's a general rule. If you want to get anything done,
tell me
start with Ainsbury for work.
Yeah. No, he
can order it away.
Tell me about New College.
Well, now I'll tell you what happened.
Deception.
I was quite a fairly leading young philosophers among his great society, talked a bit. Herbert Hart was my colleague. And then I got a first in grades, which was a very great source of surprise, Corpus Christi. Bad first, but a first, when I say bad, the examiners wrote to my tutor, Hardy. They would usually write about people who get degrees to the tutors, letters always written, saying, well, I did get a first, but of course I wasn't a flyer. In any sense, couldn't be described as it.
Yeah.
Not as good as Crossman, a man called Galley, a man called somebody else, I can't remember.
Galley the philosopher.
Galley, the elder brother was a philosopher. Yeah. Not the one you're thinking about. His elder brother, who died young, who was not very good, but still, right. Well, not as good as that, and not as good as about four others. So I put in my, but still, I got a first. Bad first is better than.
No first.
I never thought I would get it. Never. I've never valued. The one thing about me is I've never had any, I've told you often, I lack self-confidence in a high degree and never think myself much good. This is genuinely true. I've never said, what? They didn't give me a first, they must be mad. I've never been in that mood.
Yeah. Then after you feel the judgments are righteous condemnation, or righteous estimations of you at your work.
Yes, yes. I judge others by the same criteria. But I judge myself just as harshly. I'm rather stern critic. And I'm not...
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but of myself as much as anyone. And I don't think I'm really much good. I think I've got away with an awful lot. My view. My view is that I've, my entire career is securely founded was being systematically overestimated. That is my opinion.
Well, this is not my place to argue it.
All right.
I would like to put down a marker to the effect that I disagree, but let's proceed.
Thank you, thank you. Now, the thing is that, having done that, I went on doing philosophy. You see, I got a scholarship to do honor moderations and modern history, neither of which I did. I didn't at the first, because the ancient history tutor told me my classics weren't very good, no point in my doing it. But I kindly devote myself to ancient history.
Yeah.
I did not do that. Do philosophy instead. Plato, because my philosophy tutor is extremely intelligent, and my ancient history tutor was a kind of old British colonel.
Yeah.
What?
He was in his dotage.
Not quite, but he was a sort of old colonel type. Next, what happened was I wanted to go on doing philosophy. Now, in Corpus Christi College, you were not allowed to do something called PPE. Philosophy, politics, economics. Because that regard was too easy solution. Corpus was a very old-fashioned college and totally different from any other in the university. More conservative, more remote, totally law unto itself. I enjoyed it very much, but it was, I didn't realize how different it was from anywhere else. The only man who ever tried to do it had his scholarship taken away. He did do it and got a first, mm-hmm. but his scholarship I think was restored in the end, but no compound interest. Mm-hmm. But interest may have been paid on it, anyway. But anyhow, because I got a first in my first few grades, I was allowed to waste my time. So I went on doing philosophy. By this time, I was becoming more and more interested. I was sort of part of the Oxford Philosophical sort of undergraduate world. And then I got to know Crossman because of the Oxford Outlook, the meeting intelligentsia figures. He had a rather curious post. He was enormously admired by the fellows in New College, and he was made a fellow before he ever took final schools to teach ancient history and philosophy, which was unheard of. Something he would in 19th century. No philosophy, but Greek philosophy.
Yes.
And he therefore was half-time philosopher, half-time Greek historian. Now, that meant the other half had fulfilled. He thought I was exactly what he wanted, because I was a bit pedantic, interested in the subject. He had not the slightest interest in real philosophy. He was essentially a marvelous teacher. Clever, exciting, sort of bold, adored, working people up, sort of, working people up. Splendid lecturer, but all he really was interested in was Germany, German politics himself, Plato as a fascist, that kind of thing, you see.
Yes.
He needed somebody who did the pedantic stuff. Mm. There was another philosopher at New College who was already doing it, but still he had too many pupils. So he told New College that I'd been made offers by three colleges, and they didn't secure my services as a lecturer in philosophy. Might lose me forever. No college has made me any offers of any kind. This is straight lines.
Was this subsequent to your election at All Souls?
No, pre.
Pre.
So the first job I had was at New College.
Yeah.
Not as a fellow, which was a full thing, as you know,
yeah.
but a lecturer, which was a sub-fellow.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd crossed over from the undergraduate world
yeah.
to the senior world.
Yeah.
I was tremendously depressed. The most boring and pompous and priggish collection of people I ever came across. I became totally miserable. September 1932. I went to Salzburg that summer, which I enjoyed very much. I came back, which I went to from 1930 onwards, every summer. I came back to Oxford. I was given a room, New College. I went to dinner in the common room. Before the old assembled hall. Crossman was on my right. I was reduced to silence. And either I feel in the sympathetic atmosphere, which I talk non-stop,
yeah.
or I don't, which means I don't talk at all. That's unless to my neighbor. Yeah. It's a general conversation, take no part.
Yeah.
This is still true. Well, they were talking, you know, a lot of sort of donnish talk. And Crossman kept said to me, be bright, Berlin, be bright. Otherwise you'll never get on with these people.
No.
That didn't encourage me much. He was a horrible bully
yeah.
for the man.
Yeah.
I got to know him extremely well. Mm. But anyway, he was my patron. Well, in the end I began teaching, which I enjoyed. But the company in All Souls, in New College,
was
ghastly. There were three people I could talk to. There was an ancient historian called Cox, who was lively and amusing, and sensitive and very good company. And very sort of tremendous human being. There was a ridiculous ancient archaeologist called Cassin, who was just, but you could talk to him about anything because he wasn't pompous. And there was Crossman, one could talk to in fashion. And there was a philosophy tutor called Smith, who was not curious, but one could have a conversation. The rest were impossible. By which I mean they talked about the bypass, they talked about the weather, they talked about a little bit about politics, but one realized one couldn't say anything one thought. One realized that the one thing one couldn't do is express oneself or go too far or express strong opinions. Well, before that, one said nothing but strong opinions, lively conversations with undergraduates. So, when after 2 months I was elected All Souls, just total liberation. All Souls full of young men, all arrogant, all lively, older fellows who, so to speak, had to be on their toes for the younger fellows, because the majority were young, arrogant, talkative, strong opinions, and, so to speak, completely lively. I talked for 3 days and three nights, I think, fell ill in the end as a result, had sinusitis that we were taken to Amalfi.
To recover. From the sheer pleasure of being listened to.
Well, I got a terrific temperature and tremendous sinusitis and fell ill and so on. From the sheer excitement of finding myself in congenial company. Crossman was furious. He intended to, as it were, to acquire me as a kind of client. And I liberated myself rather too quickly. So about this time I fell in love. I think I perhaps told you about it. Something called Miss Lind. But I did tell him. In All Souls, it was total liberation. It was when one could chat, one could talk, I made friends very rapidly. And that was an extremely happy period of my life. 1933, 34, 35. I was terribly disapproved of by the senior fellows.
Why?
By the academic senior fellows. Because they thought I was a time-wasting chatterbox who would never write anything and wasted the time of people who might. Okay. I felt waves of disapproval, not from the politicians, quite nice to me, but from the sort of people of 50. Sumner, who later became Warden, a man called Woodward, famous English historian, a man called Brierley, professor of international law, a man called J.N. Clark, who became Regius Professor of in Cambridge and professor of Oriel College, Cambridge. These were the sort of solid academic element. They thought I was just a talking, just a chatterbox, talk too much, and didn't show any signs of sitting down to work and getting things out. It's quite what I did my first 4 years. When I produced a book on Karl Marx, they were totally astonished. I could have generated anything at all. You see, that is my reputation.
Who is your dominant intellectual influence in the All Souls before the war?
It depends what you call intellectual. My friends in All Souls, Garon Muris, the notorious Garon Muris, a year older than me. I'll answer your question in a second. My set. Who were we? I was elected as a man called Riley, who became an ambassador, and a man called Wilberforce, who became a famous judge. They went to the war. They left also, and they didn't live in Oxford. I suppose Austin, the philosopher, was elected the year after me. So I used to talk about philosophy every morning for 3 years. And it had a very dominant influence on me, simply philosophically. Otherwise, well, there's Maurice Barra, of course.
Well, can you define the influence of Austin in non-technical terms?
Again, like Hardy, he was extremely acute, extremely severe, extremely clear.
And all the things that naturally you were not.
Well, exactly. That's why I craved them and profited by them. He said things which were highly original. He wasn't just a Hardy, was rather conventional. He made me read books of exactly the kind I hated, Hegelian philosophy. He himself was not dead, but the books he was in favor of were, I couldn't understand what they meant. I was liberated by reading books he had not recommended. Horst would say to me, I read a little essay about him, as you know. He would say to me, determinism. Of course, there are have you ever met a determinist? I know they say they are, but have you ever met one? I never have. That's the kind of thing I liked.
Yeah.
You see him?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, you see him.
Very precise.
Yes. Determinism. A causes B. B causes C. C causes D. And Y causes Z. And then what? A again? In endless cycles? No. Something changes with knobs on. Now what about the knobs? That's how he talked.
Yeah.
It wasn't philosophical. He didn't talk in professional language.
No.
The point was, he talked in absolutely clear English. At the same time, the points he made were bold, original, and devastating. And that I enjoyed very much.
Yeah. Is there any way that you can define in what his philosophical originality for you consisted?
No more than anybody else, just puncturing received ideas and having devastating new ones which upset some kind of take it for granted view of something or other. Anything that blew things up. Anything which, in some way, one think that's all it is really. Anything which caused one's mind to move. Stopped one in one's tracks in some way. Questions asked to which one had no answer at all.
Can you remember an example of that?
Oh, in very simple language.
Can you remember an example where you felt the sort of mental furniture of your head being rearranged by something he said?
I wish I did. A lot of people other days experienced that, but I didn't. I don't think I did, funnily enough. I think I agreed with him to such a degree that when he said these things, it seemed to me that they were entirely right, and I hadn't thought of them.
Yeah.
But I don't think it upset. And I was wrong to say that it sort of stopped me, in the sense that it made a difference, so that I became worried. No. I'm trying to think. Yes. I don't think I accepted it. First class we ever had together. He and I held the first class in Oxford ever on the modern philosophy. Nobody had ever had such a thing before. 1935. There's a book called Mind of the World Order by an American philosopher called C.I. Lewis, professor at Harvard. Last pragmatist, which I came across in Blackwell's, never heard of him. I bought it, looked rather interesting. And I showed it to Austin, who said it was very interesting. So we thought we'd have it on that. Well, we began, there were about 20 people came, quite nice. And then the question arose about universals, let's say, about the nature of redness. And Austin said, supposing there are three red things of exactly the same hue, is there one hue? Are there three? His judgment. Is there one red color or three? I said, one. No, there aren't. There are three, he said. Then we started arguing. I suddenly realized that so far from being polite, and friendly as even before. He was determined to win. And I was suddenly cut into small pieces. Such a thing had never happened to me before. And that was something.
Yeah.
And I could see that some of the members of the seminar were very sorry for me, came to my aid, and darling wanted to prop me up.
Yeah.
That was a sudden yes. It isn't a question of changing my mind. I didn't think I ever did, in fact, change my mind. But that was my first experience of Austin in public. Now, if you ask me what anybody ever taught me anything, no, I don't think specifically he did. No. No. I don't think so. I just admired the sheer brains.
Yeah. How long did your association with Austin continue? Did it continue after the war into the...
Oh, Lord, yes.
50s?
Certainly.
When did he die?
59. We made friends.
Yeah.
To the end.
But it was his influence on you before the war that was sometimes more important than after.
Yes, it was, because it made me... Yes, it was. Oh, yes. If he praised the philosopher, I knew it was good. If he said somebody was no good, he's chuckle-headed, he would say. That was the strongest word of dispraise. Simply chuckle-headed. I can tell you a story about Austin. It was nothing with me. When he was elected, I was a junior fellow. I had to send him a telegram to St. Andrews to say, you're elected to fellowship. Congratulations. The college hopes you'll be able to dine on Monday. The answer was, thank you. Stop. I was coming to Oxford on Monday in any case. Unusual. No, no, but then what more do I want to tell you? The liberation was really at Corpus. Where I made friends, where I thought I was not stupid, where I thought I might come to something, where everyone was very friendly, and where my whole academic career really began.
Yeah. I'm wondering whether we can move forward to the post-war period.
But the point was, I never was a first-class philosopher. I was never envious of those who were. I never thought I would be. I was a perfectly happy don among dons, teaching philosophy quite well, not very well, quite well, part of a brotherhood, and perfectly happy to paddle along.
Yes.
I never wanted to shine. That's true of my life in general. And I was perfectly...
But you're not without praising. Ambition.
What?
You're not without ambition.
Not much. Not my ambition. Not much. To know, I think you have too little, you ask me. The thing which causes everything which has went wrong in my life is idleness, passivity, lack of ambition. I mean, the thing which I most hate is competition. I did not compete. I didn't compete at school. I never competed in Oxford. I have avoided situations in which I was in competition with anyone, if I could help it. But I've never, as it were, it's true that every job I ever had, apart from the last ones, I went in for. To that extent, I was competition.
Yeah.
At least I didn't know with whom I was competing.
Yeah.
But I was never in a situation where I felt I had to win. Someone said something I didn't agree with, and I simply had to do them down. I had to force my view. Talk them down, yes, because I'm such a talker, but not defeat. It sounds self-laudatory, but believe me, it's been an obstacle in my sense. If I'd been more ambitious, I would have written more, written books, and maybe come to more. Maybe discovered and invented things. and the loves came to him. I've never, when people produce wonderful books, I never say to myself, I can do better than this. By God, I don't think that's very good. Let me try.
Yeah.
I'll have a shot.
Yeah.
Never. And whenever I went to the Philosophical Society, I always thought all the arguments are valid, but it's for and against any position. That's why I realized that I couldn't be good at the subject. I was usually silent. I never dominated any philosophical discussion in my life. Never. And was always too shy to intervene. Afraid perhaps of being stabbed or defeated, or it could be cowardice. Maybe it comes the same as lack of ambition. Two things fuse into each other.
One of the things that does not figure as being very important in your narrative so far has been your relations with students.
Well, before the war, I adored teaching. I was, didn't think I was a very good tutor, because I used to take to pieces what they said. I didn't really feed them with positive doctrine.
Yeah.
Perhaps one should, some degree. All I did was to build Oxford system, Socratic dialogue, in which you, as it were, undo what they say. And I probably left too many of them in a broken state.
Yeah.
That's possible. The clever ones are all right. Second and third rate ones may not have profited. But I never, as far as I know, didn't think I ever earned a hatred or despair of any people actually. One or two I conspicuously didn't get on with.
But you didn't have close or intimate relations with students. You didn't feel caught up in their lives and their affairs and their destiny.
I was extremely anxious not to be. The one thing that I was terrified of influencing in any way.
Really?
That's been permanent in my life. I wanted to